Welcome to Pod Save America. I'm John Favreau.
I'm John Lovett.
I'm still Tommy Vitor, although I'm just about to turn into an Elden Ring.
We just have to listen to 10 minutes of Lovett and Elijah and Milo talk about video games.
C button.
I'm saying I use the triangle to go to the pouch where I keep my lantern, my horse,
what
my
are we
horse
talking about
food,
today?
And my
On
health.
Today's show, Kevin McCarthy Thank gives you. Away the House to become Speaker. Joe Biden takes his first presidential trip to the U.S.-Mexico border, and later we'll be joined by the first Gen Z member of Congress, 25-year-old Maxwell Alejandro Frost.
Freeze up my square button for my wondrous physic.
But first, we were so inspired by all the work that our Vote Save America volunteers did in the last midterm that we made new merch to celebrate you. Fresh VSA crewnecks in classic colors are available now at the Crooked Store.
No V-neck?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know.
I'll go check for myself.
Check it out. Head to crooked.com/store to shop. Get yourself one of those classic crewnecks.
Wear around town or in Limgrave.
Jesus. All right, let's get to the news.
That was so real.
Kevin McCarthy finally won the race for Speaker by giving the job to Matt Gaetz and the most MAGA members of Congress. After 5 days, 15 votes, and a midnight fight on the House floor that nearly led to violence, McCarthy got the votes of every Republican except for the six original Never Kevins, who he persuaded to just vote present with a little last-minute help from the MAGA king himself, Donald Trump. Here's a clip from late Friday night when shit got real.
Look at somebody's holding somebody back. Look at that. Oh, somebody just held somebody back. Stephanie, just look at that. It looks like a fight breaking out on the floor.
Pull him back.
Right on the face. Somebody grabbed him.
It's physical? Wait a minute. Hold on. Let's follow the camera. Kevin McCarthy looks pretty upset.
Stay civil.
Who said that?
Stay
civil. So, first question, who stopped Alabama Congressman Mike Rogers from punching Matt Gaetz in the face, and should that person be impeached?
Well, we do know it is North Carolina's Richard Hudson,
who has no flair for drama. Yeah.
You know, look, I was watching it Friday night, as we all were.
You weren't playing Elden Ring.
I literally switched. Mm. It could have been a two-screen experience, but, and I was just, I was in full Ken Watanabe mode. Just let them fight. I think it was cool, too, that because C-SPAN cameras aren't yet locked down because the speaker wasn't chosen, they got the moment where Matt Gaetz put his hand on Kevin McCarthy's cheek and said, "Do you feel in charge?"
Wouldn't you be mad? It's one thing to break up a fight, good for you, but to grip you over your mouth, he almost got like a fish hook thing.
Love and I were talking about this with Congressman Frost.
Put your grubby hands out of my mouth.
Yeah, don't putting your hands.
Sir.
We don't know. These are not hand sanitizer people.
No.
My breakdown of what happened and why the hand went over the mouth is he was trying to pull him back in an act of friendship, saying, "You don't want this. I'm trying to help you stop yourself from being in a bad position." And then Mike Rogers started fucking talking.
Yeah.
And then the other guy was like, "I got to get this guy to be quiet." And then it was just
hand on the mouth.
And the interesting backstory there on Rogers is that he's slated to become chair of the Armed Services Committee.
Sure is.
Where Gaetz also serves and reportedly got an offer from McCarthy or leadership to chair a subcommittee in Armed Services if he agreed to vote present for McCarthy, and Rogers didn't like that concession very much because Rogers thinks there were other people who deserved to be chair of that subcommittee, whatever it is, over Matt Gaetz, which is probably all the people.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I think they're both are currently on the committee, and the closer you get to Matt Gaetz, the more you understand how far he should be from chairing a committee. There is a moment where you can see Matt Gaetz mouthing the word committee at either McCarthy or one of his goons. So that's why there's been this speculation. Although then McCarthy says nothing was promised, but two things. One, he's a liar.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
That's important. And two,
that's how we got this job.
A lot of this is a wink and a nod. Even as we're recording this, we know some of the kind of changes to McCarthy's positions he took between Thursday and Friday, but we don't totally understand what those final few concessions were to get those six goobers to the present votes.
Yeah, we should all try to be a little more present. But Richard Hudson, the congressman, John, UNC grad, elected student body president of the College Republican, staffer for elected officials, and his wife, was Kellyanne Conway's chief of staff. I took when you said in the prep, what do we know about this guy? I took you literally.
You know what? Wow. That was educational. I literally had never heard of his name before.
No, I neither. I was hoping he's like a wrestler now. Or something fun.
No. What do we? Well, Lovett, you said we don't know exactly what happened. Like when we recorded Thursday's pod, McCarthy had already made just about every concession possible, and still didn't have the votes. What changed between Thursday and Friday night? What do we know about what changed? I don't think we know. I think you're right. I don't think we know everything.
I don't think we know everything. I believe it is between Thursday and Friday that he finally conceded and went from 5-1 votes to get the to get the no confidence vote.
Thursday we morning.
Did. Yeah, we did know that.
But we didn't know that it. Did we know that it switched from 5-1 before you recorded? It was like
yeah,
right then.
Yeah, it was. Here's what we knew. We knew that all these concessions were floated. We knew that Chip Roy and about 14 of the 21 holdouts might move based on these concessions, but they hadn't yet.
Right.
And then I said to Dan during the recording, oh, Matt Gaetz just said, either Kevin McCarthy's going to have to withdraw from the race or live the entirety of his speakership in a straitjacket based on the rules we're working on
and then,
was a hint that maybe Matt Gaetz was coming around.
And then Kevin McCarthy just went running up to Matt Gaetz is like, tie me up, baby. I'm in. I want this title.
Here's what we know. Kevin McCarthy, he's the new LBJ. He's the master of the Congress. I mean, what I think happened is we started to read, thanks to all the leaks, all these rule changes that were going to be put in place. And then Thursday night, I think they went through them all night and he probably got them on paper and locked everybody down, because the next day, Friday, is when he flipped those 14 Republican votes. And then he went after, those are the people who like really wanted substantive changes. The Roy Chips, the Chip Roys.
Yeah, your Chips Roy. Your Chips Roy. They're moving away from, the other ones are...
Chips of Roy.
They don't want to do anymore.
Done?
It's great. I think keep going. They don't want to do the omnibus. Republicans hate these big omnibus bills they feel like they have to vote for, so they want individual spending bills from each of the committees. They want the debt ceiling tied to spending cuts. Those are some of the big ones.
Yeah, and then once he got the 14, that put a lot of... And this was McCarthy's plan, which worked out. This put a lot of pressure on the 6 original Never Kevins because now you had all these switches. And so now what are they going to do? And apparently they had worked out a plan, or they had discussed a plan, the 6 Never Kevins, because none of them wanted to actually vote for McCarthy because they've all gone on, like
right,
Gates said, I'd rather be waterboarded than vote for McCarthy. You know,
They went way too far.
So they said, all right, none of us are going to vote for him. If we all vote present, then we won't have to vote for him, but he can still get it and whatever. But apparently that plan hadn't been like firmed up when they did the 14th ballot. So Gaetz was like, suddenly they needed a yes vote from Gaetz and not a present vote to actually get McCarthy speaker because of some absences. And Gaetz is like, fuck no, I'm not going to be the one to do
it. He goes president and everybody claps and cheers thinking it's over, but none of them know how to count votes except for McCarthy. He goes sprinting over to Matt Gaetz. Is like, what's your problem, man?
Yeah.
But I mean, Matt Gaetz, he's such a smug prick. He said on the record, I ran out of things I could even imagine to ask for, which is obnoxious, but also true. And I think they were all looking for a way to just climb down.
Yeah,
no, I mean, he was effusive towards the end there. He could never vote yes because he said he was never Kevin, and he stuck with that. But
yeah,
there was that moment where basically they realized they need one of these 6 to flip to yes, and they were all just gathered around Lauren Boebert and Matt Gaetz, just the whole apparatus of the fucking Congress gathered around two of the most disgusting human beings in public life.
MTG's got Donald Trump on the phone just throwing it at people.
Yeah, I was going to say, because he's a messy bitch who loves drama, yeah. Donald Trump was involved.
He's watching. Also, by the way, do you know how fucked up and stupid and deranged you are that MTG is rebranding as a sane person based on your misadventures? She's walking around being like, guys, I think this has gotten out of hand. Isn't it a shame? Can't we come together and govern? I've got Donald Trump on the phone. He'd love to help.
I think she's bummed. I think she wanted to be part of the insurrection. She kind of missed out.
Yeah. Like Lauren Boebert was like, I'm taking that spotlight now. Yeah, no, there's a great picture of MTG holding her phone that says DT on it. And she's trying to give the phone to Matt Rosendale, who's one of the Never Kevins. And he basically was like, get away. Don't put me in that position.
Do that to
I
me.
Can't talk to him.
Didn't he say like, don't do me like that?
So, I think he did.
Yeah. So she instead, Trump, I guess, talked to Biggs, Andy Biggs from Arizona, who originally ran against McCarthy, and talked to Gaetz and told him to knock the shit off. Said basically, you're making me look bad.
The thing is, there's a lot of victory has 1,000 parents, but in the days leading up to it, you know, McCarthy is now going on television being like, I want to thank my friend Donald Trump who helped get me all the way there. Donald Trump knows how to support somebody if he really wants to. He was going on Truth Social saying like, hey guys, maybe Kevin will be good. I don't know. I say give him a shot, but I'm not crazy about it.
He couldn't have been more predictable in all this. It was perfect. He did just enough to get himself in the stories. I mean, at first he refused to come out in support of Kevin. Then the vote happened. Then he did his sort of tepid true thing. But you even had reps like Ralph Norman saying like, I disagree with Trump. This is not his fight. This is our fight with McCarthy. Like, they were not scared of Trump.
Yeah, Boebert said that too.
Which was impressive. And then as soon as it became clear McCarthy was going to win, Trump gets into gear. He starts calling people, right? But like, Hakeem Jeffries becomes speaker. Trump's going to find a way to take credit. I mean, this was laughable, laughable nonsense. I did love his tweet, though. His truth. I greatly helped Kevin McCarthy attain the position of Speaker of the House. I did our country a big favor.
Yeah, you did.
Subtle.
Yeah, you did. So now that the House has a speaker, they also are voting any minute now, as we record on Monday afternoon, on a new set of rules for the chamber that will empower the most extreme Republicans. Love it. You mentioned a few. What are some of the most consequential here that we're all going to have to live with?
The most important is the debt ceiling, that they have secured a promise that there won't be a vote on lifting the debt ceiling without spending cuts. Those are a non-starter for the White House and for the Democratic Senate. So that sets off some kind of standoff over the debt ceiling. That is by far the biggest issue to come. Beyond that, the fact that there are three Republicans on the Rules Committee, which is three Freedom Caucus members as part of the Republican majority on the Rules Committee, means those three members have veto over what comes out of that committee. That's going to be a very big deal.
We should say why
bigger than
that.
Yeah. I mean, the Rules Committee in the House sets the terms and conditions of debate on any bill that goes forward. I think the normal process is like the Judiciary Committee votes on a bill and then it goes to the Rules Committee and then they structure how it's handled on the open floor. So that's just like enormous power. It used to be called the Speaker's Committee because that was how the Speaker controlled the floor. Kevin has just handed over the keys now.
And basically, because they have, yeah, there's nine members on the Rules Committee, Freedom Caucus gets three, Democrats have four. So now there's only two non-Freedom Caucus members that are Republicans on the committee. So basically, the Freedom Caucus, by joining with the Democrats, who are going to probably oppose most things that Republicans want to do in that Rules Committee anyway, can effectively stop any bill or any amendment from coming to the floor that they do not like. They can't necessarily put anything on the floor they like because they would need a majority on the committee and Democrats might not want to give them that, but they can kill just about everything.
And by the same token, if the non-Freedom Caucus members want to get something onto the floor that the Freedom Caucus does not want,
that's
they
right.
will need Democrats.
Yep.
And Democrats will play ball,
because
we always do. We love playing ball.
So process-wise, that is, it sounds really complicated, maybe boring, but it is extremely consequential.
Deal.
And then I think the debt sort of dovetails with the debt ceiling promise, too, because you can make a promise, whatever. But like now, the only way to pass a clean debt ceiling hike is by either McCarthy agreeing to it, which now he will not do.
Well, as of today, says he will not do. The one criticism that is correct by these Freedom Caucus members is that McCarthy says things that aren't true and changes his mind and changes position all the time. True.
Well, and now they have a mechanism to hold him accountable, because if he chooses to try to do this, they can immediately try to remove him with just one person calling for a vote. So McCarthy's sort of hamstrung there. There is, we've talked about this briefly before, there's a discharge petition, which basically every Democrat, if a bill has been stuck in the Rules Committee for more than 30 days, you can file a discharge petition with a majority of the members of the House, meaning like every Democrat and now just four Republicans could file a discharge petition. And then after 30 days would get that out of the committee if it's been stuck there. So they can do that, but that's a very long and complicated process that doesn't necessarily always work just because it requires a lot of coordination. And as we said before, those House Republicans that agree to join the Democrats on that could very well face primary challenges, though already Brian Fitzpatrick was a more moderate Republican, a House member from Pennsylvania, has said he will do that if it comes to that.
Right. So you basically have a situation where Republicans try to do brinksmanship of the debt ceiling. Democrats have already said in the Senate, Democrats and the Biden administration have said that's a non-starter. That fails. Then you try to get a clean bill through. That fails. then barring that, you have to go to this discharge position. It is high risk, not just because it is a difficult thing to coordinate. If it fails, you don't get to do it again. Like, you get one shot at this discharge position on this issue. The whole House has to vote.
Sort of like the Armageddon movie.
Well, right. Oh. And so basically...
So who's drilling and who's inserting
the
nuke?
You just get one shot and then that's...
This got a little sexual, the way it sounded to me.
Oh, it's a discharge position.
And so, just how it's sounding. But so, because what could happen is you could end up...
Doesn't matter how you start, it matters how we finish.
Kevin... That was what
in the words of Kevin McCarthy.
It was terrible.
How you finish for the American people.
I'm scared where this is going. Go back to your substance, nerd.
The point is, a discharge position is two votes. The first is one to say, let's vote on this on the floor. The second is to actually pass it. If the second one fails, you've lost your ability to have a vote, a clean vote in the House. Yeah. And so now then you go to... I think some really, really untested fail-safes. One is, and it's back, the Treasury Department making a trillion-dollar coin, which the Biden administration has already said they won't do. And then there's the outside move, which is saying the 14th Amendment says we have to pay all these bills, so we're just going to pay them.
Yeah, not good. I mean,
none of them are good.
All of the spending stuff is bad. He also agreed to unlimited amendments on spending bills, which means you could basically filibuster House spending bills now, just sort of de facto by putting random amendments on them. And also that McCarthy said that any increase in debt ceiling would be accompanied by cuts to federal spending, and that discretionary spending will be capped at FY 2022 level, so this year's level, which is like $130 billion cut, which is not really doable. So they'll probably get into defense spending cuts, too, if they actually go through with this. So in a sense, Kevin McCarthy handed his caucus a whole bunch of really, really bad votes coming down the pike.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, all of this is going to be horrific for the country, particularly if we breach the debt ceiling. It could cause a, you know, economic catastrophe that's much worse than just a regular recession. But just to talk about the politics for a second, because the Freedom Caucus demanded was so extreme, right, which is not just like some cuts accompanying the debt ceiling hike, like they want to vote on a balanced budget amendment.
It's just impossible in 10 years.
Which means that anything you would do, any kind of vote you would take to get the necessary cuts to abide by their craziness would gut Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid. So basically, these people are going to go in the next year. Republicans are going to say, if you don't let us gut Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid, we will blow up the global economy. That's going to be their position. Not popular. And I'll tell you, it's not popular.
And it's why you're already seeing, I will not ever call them moderate Republicans. They're not moderate Republicans, but they're Republicans that have been around longer than these people are starting to say things like, we have ways around this. And also, wait, isn't the debt ceiling just cashing checks we've already written?
It is.
And so I do think a lot of this is going to be about how much are these Freedom Caucus members daring Republicans from swing districts or Biden districts to just say, I'm sorry, but I'm voting with the Democrats to get things done.
Yeah, but there will be a confrontation over this. And I do think like the discharge petition could work for the debt ceiling because it's just a clean bill. It seems like to avoid a government shutdown, it can't work because a lot of those bills to fund the government don't come up and they're not finished until like right before the government's about to shut down and the discharge petition takes 30 days. So on that one, like we're headed towards a shutdown at some point in the fall.
As I was sort of looking through the deal, what I found myself thinking is, all right, there are some exit ramps on the debt ceiling. Let's hope we use one. Let's hope that works. But man, are we hurtling towards some kind of government shutdown, partial government shutdowns. That's going to be the cycle.
It's going to be people's Social Security. I mean, it's
the mess.
Bad shit.
It's called soccer.
It's called football.
Soccer.
Football.
Domino's best deal ever lets you get any pizza, including stuffed crust, with any toppings for $9.99.
Okay, we can agree on that.
Yeah, fully.
So, pineapple? Don't ruin it. Get any pizza, including stuffed crust, with any toppings for $9.99. Finally, something everyone can get behind.
And if the refs disagree, that's between them and Domino's. Which means the only thing left to fight over is who's ordering.
Domino's. Prices higher for some locations. Excludes XL and specialty pizzas. Select this offer from 6:15 to 7:26. Online only. Size availability varies by crust type. Max 7 toppings. 6 for pan and New York style crust. Minimum purchase required for delivery. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary.
Want to pull off the season's freshest trends? You just need the right shoes. That's where Designer Shoe Warehouse comes in. Loving wide-leg jeans? Pair them with sleek, low-profile sneakers. Obsessed with the sheer trend? Try it with mesh flats. Feeling boho? Comfy sandals nail the whole free-spirited thing. Find on-trend shoes from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at DSW.
Saving money on your next project? Now at Menards. Menards is the leading supplier of quality roof and floor trusses. Choose from our large selection of residential and post-frame trusses or design custom trusses specifically for your project. Get started on your building project today in-store or on Menards.com. Plus, view our weekly flyer for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
House Republicans can't really pass any legislation because the Senate Democrats can, like, kill all their any crazy shit that they send over. The only power they have is to do three things, two of which we talked about: blow up the global economy by breaching the debt ceiling, shutting down the government if they refuse to fund it. And then the third thing is they're really excited about their investigations that they got teed up.
Super pumped.
So New York Times reports that incoming Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan has that. That's fun. He was also going to chair a special subcommittee to investigate the Department of Justice, the FBI, the intelligence agencies, and will demand access to open investigations by the Justice Department and classified intelligence. What do you do about this if you're the White House or Democrats in Congress and you start in the, you're the DOJ and you get asked for information about an ongoing investigation?
They're going to say no, absolutely not. And they're going to cite precedent going back decades. And I don't know that they will yield on that. And I'm not really sure what Jim Jordan thinks he can do about it. You know, like there is a Judiciary Committee. They do oversight over the Department of Justice. There is an Intelligence Committee that does intel oversight. This is just sort of a special, they're calling it a Church Committee 2.0. The Church Committee investigated real abuses by the intelligence community, things like MK Ultra, where Americans were given acid to see if it was a truth serum, like the surveillance of Martin Luther King Jr., et cetera. It led to the creation of the intelligence oversight committees. This proposal is just payback for people investigating Donald Trump. That's all it is.
It's also the House rules package doesn't fundamentally alter the relationship between Congress and the administration. It's not a law.
No.
It's not a it's a sop to Jim Jordan. It's their internal rules. It's something that McCarthy has promised Jim Jordan. It doesn't suddenly require the DOJ to behave in a different way.
And the Biden people have signaled, like, we will go along with legitimate oversight and we will not go along with stuff like this. I mean, they're basically saying that.
They're going to take all this. This is all going to be fought out in court. And I think that the Biden administration probably feels very confident that they'll prevail. Yeah. And by the way, I think that Kevin McCarthy, when he gave Jordan the concession, didn't think it was much of a concession. It's like, you know what? He wants to go tell the base that he did this. He wants to go on TV, make a bunch of noise. And then when the Biden administration rejects the subpoenas, he can call them lawless and he can go on Fox and, have a great time.
And I'd also point out that Jim Jordan has in the past shown that he doesn't actually believe congressional subpoenas carry much weight because he is currently or he just was in defiance of one. The one thing that I did appreciate that the White House did was basically, so, you know, Jordan and some other Republicans put in a bunch of requests last year and basically said, like, new Congress, clock starts again, which really, I think, pissed them off.
Yeah.
But those were also requests from individual members, not like through the committee. Right. So I think they're going to slow roll them and they're going to push them back and they're going to participate in legitimate inquiry while at the same time recognizing even though they may have the power of the gavel, these are not going to be on the level investigation.
Yeah, it's fun. No, I think what you're telling is that the Jim Jordan types put in their oversight requests too early and the Biden folks are like, oh, sorry, calendar you guys haven't ended yet.
Mm. Yeah.
Come back, call us next year.
I mean, look, it's going to be a circus, but I think will they find a Trump judge or two who's like, you know, Eileen Cannon in the Trump investigation matter, who just like goes with them? Yeah, maybe. But like, I think even the more conservative appeals courts and the Supreme Court have shown that on some of these requests by Trump or Trumpy people, they're like, no, you're not gonna do this.
And they all lean towards the executive branch having unchecked power.
Right.
Sort of
yeah,
there.
Exactly.
That's their safe space.
All right. So one of the big investigations Republicans have promised is into Joe Biden's handling of immigration at the U.S.-Mexico border, which he just visited in El Paso on Sunday for the first time as president. In the last year, more migrants have been apprehended trying to cross the border illegally than at any time since 1960. The White House just laid out a new enforcement plan. It would, on one hand, allow more migrants from more countries to apply for a 2-year work permit in the U.S., but it would also require asylum seekers to book an appointment for their claim to be heard before they arrive here, which means they will no longer be able to just show up at the border and apply or stay in the U.S. while they wait for a court date. Republicans attacked the plan and the visit is too little too late. No surprise there. But some immigration activists called it a humanitarian disgrace. So win-win for Joe Biden. Tommy, what do you think of the trip and the plan, which seemed to have hit the sweet spot of satisfying no one?
No one. Let's do the trip first. I mean, I think the debate around whether Joe Biden should go like himself look at the border really reminded me of when Republicans used to say Barack Obama won't say radical Islamic terrorism. That became their one stop sort of catch all attack on him for dealing with terrorism. And it made a complicated problem sound simple and rhetorical. Eventually, we used those words to try to move the debate forward. Spoiler alert, it did not. but I think Biden is in a similar spot where he knows just visiting the border changes nothing. Maybe, though, this will change the conversation, take away a Republican talking point. We'll see. Already, it seems like what is happening is Republicans are saying, you went to the border, but you didn't actually see actual migrants.
Yeah, you don't go to the border. You're refusing to go to the border. You go to the border. It's a photo op.
I mean, under what circumstance would Joe Biden have gone to the border and the Republicans would have said, bravo, Mr. President,
never.
You
right.
did it.
Never, never.
So what do you think about the plan, since that's more substantive than just the border visit?
I mean, I think like there is a real challenge at the border. More and more people are coming. It's left border communities on both sides of the U.S. and Mexico border overwhelmed and unable to provide food and housing and services for the people who need them. It also has left our immigration system overwhelmed. Immigration courts have backlogs that are years and years long. So Biden is trying to address this big, multifaceted, complicated problem piece by piece. And a lot of the recent migration is migrants from Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua. So these are countries where there's a really challenging humanitarian situation and a political asylum case to be made because there's repressive leaders. So they're saying like, okay, we're creating this humanitarian parole program where 30,000 migrants from each of these countries can come. If you have a sponsor, you can buy a plane ticket, pass a background check, et cetera. But at the same time, they're increasing penalties for people who go try to seek asylum from those countries through Mexico. So the idea is address this very legitimate asylum need, but also do so in a way that disincentivizes people paying smugglers to get to the border or just going through Mexico on your own. I think it's a flawed approach in a lot of different ways, but I think that the Biden team's position is basically this is a decade-old problem. Congress will not do anything to solve it. This is what we can do, so we're going to try to like bite at this piece by going after these countries first. Longer term, like the only way to stop migration from Venezuela is to help the humanitarian situation in Venezuela. But we have there's a lot we can do to help there, but we obviously can't fix it as a country. So I think, you know, it's a start. I don't love the use of Title 42. I don't love the way Remain in Mexico has gone from a Trump policy to a Biden policy. I don't love sort of how asylum has gotten completely changed over the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, it's, I think that like the contradiction I think at the core of this is that the Biden administration is using Title 42 to implement a policy in part to deter people from doing something extremely dangerous,
right,
which is seeking something they're allowed to seek, which is asylum. But at the same time as they're using Title 42, they're also in court trying to get rid of Title 42, which I think highlights the kind of catch 22 that they're in, because the current policy is not humane. People sleeping on the streets in El Paso, these years long backlogs, the lack of resources, the border being overwhelmed. We are in an inhumane situation. So like the advocates, I think, are right when they point out that like people have a right to seek asylum.
Absolutely.
They shouldn't need to be able to afford a plane ticket
Absolutely.
And have somewhere to go. But then the Biden administration says, hey, we put something like this in place for Venezuela, and it did stop the number of people by 70% trying to get in the country in a dangerous way without permission.
Yeah, the Venezuela piece of this was basically a pilot program back in October, and now they're extending it to Haiti, Cuba, and Nicaragua.
And one of the reasons they're extending it is because it worked, the pilot program, in the sense that
it reduced it by
70%. It has been an effective deterrent, and then it reduced illegal border crossing by 70% from Venezuela. No, but the problem is, and the humanitarian advocates aren't just correct from a humanitarian perspective on about asylum, but potentially from a legal perspective as
yes,
well.
That's a
and
big problem.
It's international law that we have agreed to abide by, but it's also Congress has made it fairly clear that you can come and apply for asylum whether you show up at a port of entry or anywhere else, right? And so the Biden administration saying that you can only do it from home is for sure intended to make the process more orderly and fair. But if the law is you can show up and do it anyway, like I don't know. And the Ninth Circuit basically said to the Trump administration, like, yeah, you can't force people to apply somewhere else. Like they can apply for asylum if they get here. So I don't know that this new plan will survive court challenges.
This plan may not survive in court. Title 42 won't survive, may not survive for that much longer. There's also a piece of this, which is the Biden administration saying that if you've moved through another country where
right.
you did not seek asylum, you can't seek asylum here.
Well, yeah, which the idea there is if you leave Venezuela, you go through Mexico. Why didn't you apply for asylum in Mexico? Why did you come all the way to the United States?
Right.
Is the question there. And look, all of this it's what you said, Tommy. Like, this is maybe the best of a lot of bad options facing the Biden administration, because the only way this gets fixed is with new laws. Those are off the table because we just talked about how Republicans aren't going to let the government stay open and may breach the debt ceiling, right? So they can't even get that done. They're not going to get immigration done. So barring that, if you're the Biden administration, you only have so many options and so many resources.
And I think another piece of this, though, for Biden, especially with Venezuela and Cuba, is more in like the classical foreign policy bucket, which is our policy towards Venezuela has been to sanction the shit out of them and recognize a guy who is an opposition leader as the president for the last 6 years. That has completely failed. We need to rethink these sanctions regimes we have in place that are crippling the economies of these countries and then wondering why people are leaving them and trying to seek safety elsewhere.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying like the United States is the entire reason that the Venezuelan economy has collapsed. Like Maduro is very much in charge and responsible for governance of his own country. But U.S. sanctions have failed. The policy of recognizing Juan Guaido, this opposition leader, as the president has failed. And we need to move on from that and just rethink these policies, I think, whole cloth.
There are all these like larger structural problems that contribute to the migration challenges that we face. There are past and present foreign policies. There is climate change is going to create more refugees all over the world than ever before and is continuing to do so. There's violence in all these countries, right? So you got to solve all that. In the immediate term, there's people showing up in El Paso and they have converted their convention center to a shelter. And you have these cities all along the border and increasingly cities all throughout the United States that just don't have the resources to care for migrants who show up in a humane way, even when they want to.
Yeah. So
and that's a real challenge for cities, for border communities, for states, like all over the place. And you got to do something about it.
Yeah. So I do think that's where, like, similar to that moment when the speaker vote was failing and you had Biden with McConnell on a bridge showing the success of bipartisanship into this kind of thorny, very difficult, impossible to win issue with a lot of incredible pain and immiseration. Like Biden says that extreme Republicans are going to use it as an issue, but they have a choice. They can keep using immigration to try to score political points, or they can help solve the problem and come together to fix the broken system. So he's going down there and he's putting himself on the side of, I would like to work on this issue with Congress. Comprehensive immigration reform is obviously almost certainly off the table, given the makeup of this Congress. As you said, do I think it is inconceivable they can't find ways to address this in a smaller way, in some way through Congress. I don't think it is impossible. I think he has to put himself on the side of trying and then leave it to these extreme Republicans to kill it. And I don't know, politically, I don't know what else he would be able to do.
I think they'll try, but you know, you have the acute near-term problem, you have the long-term structural problems. And I think you have a Republican Party that doesn't want the problem solved.
Yeah.
That's why we focus on the wall. That's why we focus on the border visit. And frankly, we have a country that's a lot less welcoming to immigration than I think all of us would want it to be.
Well, even to yes, and to your point, Sinema and Kyrsten Sinema and Cornyn tried something narrow to add it to the omnibus at the end of last year, and Republicans killed it. Because well, you're right, like Tommy said, there's a Republican Party that doesn't want this problem, any part of this.
They wouldn't
problem
get solved through DACA when they had Donald Trump telling them they wanted it.
And just
he wanted it. I mean,
you know, the last major immigration reform is 1986. George W. Bush tried this. It got through the House. Republicans killed it in the Senate. Obama tried to get something through. Republicans blocked it in the House. We have been kind of in this debate. And what happened in both the Bush administration and the Obama administration is Democrats and both administrations compromised and pushed forward a ton of enforcement provisions, a ton of security procedures. And then the hardliners dismiss it as amnesty, and things just keep getting worse and worse and worse.
But to your point, Tommy, about the attitudes in the country. We haven't talked about the politics really yet. The percentage of people who say that increasing security along the U.S.-Mexico border to reduce illegal crossings, quote, should be an important goal, has risen to 73% from 68% 3 years ago. This is according to a recent Pew poll. This was cited in the New York Times. The increase is largely driven by Democrats, 59% today versus 49% then. Now, lest everyone think that, like, suddenly all Democrats and Americans became very resistant to immigration in general. When you ask questions about, like, should people who are here, undocumented people here, be given a path to citizenship, or you ask about DACA, you ask about children who are here, the percentage of people who want to welcome those people and want to give people, immigrants, a path to citizenship is quite high. It's, in fact, a majority. But there is a difference in politics in how we should handle people who are already here, who are undocumented, and what we should do about people who are coming over the border now. And part of that difference, the disparity, is people thinking, and a lot of immigrants who are here, people who came here and have since been naturalized, think this too. They think, okay, I came here, I stood in line, I did everything right, and or I know people who have been here for years and still don't have citizenship, even though they're doing everything right, and yet someone comes over the border and right now, and they get to stay here. Right. And so there's this feeling of this fairness where the attitudes in general in the country become more generous to people who are here, who are working, you know, who want to be here, and more worried about border security and people coming over here now.
And I do think that sort of ties together a kind of political necessity and a practical necessity. And it is why I think the Democratic high level messaging on this issue has not changed in basically 20 years, which is we are a nation of immigrants. We are a nation of laws. We need to secure the border and have border enforcement while at the same time welcoming and opening our doors to people seeking a better life in America. Like you could, that message has been the same for a very long time, both because I think politically, the only way you get to that generous and welcoming and progressive solution is by reassuring people that once you've created that more generous and progressive set of immigration policies, that the border and the laws will be enforced because you have created incentive for people who want to come here.
Yeah. And it's political, but it's also just like a practical thing.
Yes.
Right? Which is, you know, we can allow a lot more migrants and refugees and asylum seekers into this country, but we can't do it if we're not going to have an orderly process for it. We can't just have people streaming through here because then it puts too much of a burden on cities.
And it turns people against the openness and the progressive outcomes that we want.
And it's not humane to the migrants.
It's not.
Yeah, the one area I do think that the Biden administration has not sort of hit its goals is refugee policy. Yep. They've set caps for allowing refugees in, I think like well over 100,000. I think we, you know, last year we maybe got to 17,000 people actually got in. So I think there could be a little more work done there. Obviously, this all got very complicated with the war in Ukraine. I think there's a lot that could be said about the way Ukrainian refugees were welcomed compared to refugees from other countries who are black and brown. In many cases, the way Afghan refugees were not welcomed in a lot of cases. So like it's
still not being welcomed. Yeah.
Yes, that's a whole other conversation.
And just the fact that like even with, you know, Joe Biden is going to Texas. He is greeting Governor Abbott when he arrives and has handed him the letter. And then Abbott goes on television and doesn't just say that Joe Biden has failed, that Joe Biden can't succeed. He will never succeed. Because the point you made, this is an annuity to them.
Yeah, he wants to run on this.
When they can't write, when they can't talk about inflation, when it's not working to talk about critical race theory to fund the police, this is their political fund. This is what they go back to again and again and again. The migrant caravan coverage will start as we head into the fall, and it will continue.
And look, there's a right-wing media ecosystem and infrastructure that wants to talk about only this. I tuned into my guy Ben Shapiro today on the way into the office. He skipped over the speaker debate, said he didn't care. It didn't matter who got the speaker job. He skipped some other big hot button news story and went right to immigration because that's all the conservatives want to talk about.
Yeah. This is a
great episode, Ben.
We will hear this quite a bit over the next 2 years as we head into 2024, hear about immigration. Okay. When we come back, Lovett and I talk to Congressman Maxwell Alejandro Frost.
Big transfer news today.
Who's moving?
Me. To the couch. With Domino's best deal ever since they just added stuffed crust.
Any pizza, any toppings, now with stuffed crust for $9.99.
It's a long-term contract with no release clause.
Only $9.99? Yeah, that sounds like the move. I'm heading straight to
Domino's.
Prices higher for some locations. Excludes XL and specialty pizzas. Select this offer from 6/15 through 7/26. Online only. Size availability varies by crust type. Max 7 toppings, 6 for pan and New York style crust. Minimum purchase required for delivery. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary.
Joining us now is the new representative from Florida's 10th District in Orlando, the first Gen Z member of Congress, Maxwell Alejandro Frost. Congressman, welcome to Pod Save America.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
You called your first week in Congress a shit show, which seems like a fair and even charitable description. What was going through your mind during all those votes for Speaker?
Well, you know, it changed every day. But like when we were in the chamber at like midnight doing those votes, it was a little bit more exciting, obviously, and also depressing when you think about, you know, this is the body making decisions for our country, and there's a physical altercation going on the other side of the aisle. I was just thinking about this the other day, that I would get a lot of calls from family and friends saying, what's with the chaos? It must be crazy. And it is, right? What was going on? But for me, I would like give my, I'd say Jeffries when they'd say Frost, and then I'd be free for that's while other people said, you know, voted. So there wasn't a lot of like physical chaos per se. But it was also chaotic. So it was interesting kind of squaring the two, you know?
How close were you? What kind of angle did you get on the part in the moment when somebody
Mike Rogers?
Well, no, but who, when somebody put their face? It's tough when someone uses their hand on your mouth to pull you away from an altercation. Could you see it? How close were you?
I did see it. I was on the other side of the aisle. I was sitting with a bunch of freshmen. We were all sitting together, and I did see it happen. I'm surprised they didn't get in a fight because, I mean, if someone puts their finger in my mouth. You know, on the House floor. I don't know, you know.
It's not good.
No, I saw what happened. I mean, it was wild. You know, I was getting a lot of texts, people saying, I had one of my friends text me and say, go over there. I was like, I'm not going over there. I'm going to sit right here, you know. But just pretty wild.
It's a go over there. Whose side are you on?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that was the wise move. Did you have any fun or weird or terrifying conversations while you were on the floor? A lot of people talked about there was AOC talking to Paul Gosar at one point. Did you have anything like that?
Not necessarily. You know, I kind of, you know, did my vote, and I took the opportunity to speak with a lot of other members and make some good relationships. But I did not really go and have some like interesting, wild conversations with people on the other side. I thought about going over and saying hi to some of the Republican members from Florida who were kind of part of that group at the beginning and just kind of seeing what's up. But I decided to kind of let the process play out and, you know, maybe introduce myself at another time. The funny thing is a lot of people in Florida have been asking for a freshman photo, like a bipartisan photo. And I was talking with Jared Moskowitz that night at like midnight. I was like, maybe tonight's the night to pull everybody together. but there was a fight anyways, so we didn't do it.
all right, so you've gotten quite a bit of coverage as the first Gen Z member of Congress. I've seen a bunch of profiles. How are you handling all the attention?
Well, you know, I it's been a lot. It's been different for me. I'm used to being on the staff side and, you know, working on campaigns and everything. But I've really taken this opportunity to talk about like what's going on in Florida, what's going on locally, talk about the anxieties and hopes and dreams of young people and at least young folks who like agree with me on a lot of issues, and really think about it that way. But I think it's important to like really stay grounded in the district, in home, right? Because those are the folks that sent me here. And so I'm always careful to not, you know, appear at like, you know, the celebrity culture is real and celebrity culture in our politics is also real. And sometimes it's okay to admire people, but it gets to a point where we feel like there's this one politician that's going to save us all. And this is not how our system works, right? It's not meant for one person to be able to do it all. We need a movement inside and outside the halls of Congress. So it's always exciting, but I always like to tell people it's going to take all of us. It's not the Maxwell Frost show. It really is going to take a lot more folks who, you know, think alike so we can pass real legislation that's going to have like transformational change for people across the country.
Pretty tough shot at Chris Coons.
What do you think older generations misunderstand most when it comes to your generation's view of politics?
Yeah, you know, a message I get a lot, and this is no flag to anyone who has sent this message to me or said it, because it's really, it really means a lot and I get where people are coming from. But something we hear a lot of is the young people will save us. And I get where that comes from. But, you know, I think like young folk, we're not looking to like save everyone. We just want to be a part of it, right? We want to be a part of it. We want to be heard. And it shouldn't just be up, you know, up to young people to save everyone, right? We need a multiracial, multi-generational movement, all of us working together for a better world, seven generations in the future. And so that's something I think that's sometimes misunderstood. We want to be a part of the conversation. We want to be centered at points, but we don't want to be the lone people working to, you know, fix these problems that have been around for generations. So I'd say that's something I'd say. And again, it's not to offend anyone who said that, because I understand where people are coming from. But I think it's important that we all see ourselves as a part of the solution and not just like young people.
So you are Gen Z. We are millennials. Now, a lot of people had hoped that the turnout that we would learn from the turnout that Gen Z had really helped make the difference. And Gen Z did turn out, but actually not to the same extent that millennials turned out to help prevent there from being a red wave. What can you do to learn from us as millennials, as your elders, as the previous generation? How do we inspire you? How do we help you succeed?
How do we inspire you? It's such a great
How do we inspire you? This is a great question.
Thank you.
You know, unbelievable.
I've been looking at a lot of the numbers, and I think a lot of times folks are expecting, because of like what we see on the news, first Gen Z member of Congress, March for Lives, et cetera, like Gen Z to come out and outvote everybody. And what we know to be true is since the beginning of our country, the youth vote, especially like the younger people, 18 through 25, have always been really the smallest piece of the pie, right? And that's for many different reasons. There's a lot of institutional barriers to voting. Voting is seen as an extracurricular for a lot of young people. It's not like built into, you know, schooling the way it should be. It comes at a time when you're 18 years old, where you're applying to college, you're falling in love. All this stuff is happening, which is a great argument for lowering the voting age for a lot of municipal elections. So it's part of it. It's more of a habit. But all that being said, Gen Z can make up a portion of the vote that can really tip up these elections, right? It's not always the biggest voting block that is, you know, if people turn out normally, right? You're looking for these blocks that you can turn out that might not be the biggest slice, but in these neck and neck races can mean the difference. That's what happened in Georgia with Senator Warnock both times. We've seen this happen in different races across the country. So, and when you look at the numbers, Gen Z at our current age, we're voting at higher numbers than any other generation has ever done at this current age right now. And I think it's important to look at that because it gives me a lot of hope. I'm not trying to pit generations against each other.
I am.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah. It shows me we're going in the right direction. And hey, half of Gen Z can't even vote yet. The youngest Gen Zer is like 12 years old. So I think we have a good opportunity here. I think we're trending in the right direction. There's still a lot of work to be done, but people shouldn't say, oh, young people aren't voting. We shouldn't pay attention to them. We're voting at the highest numbers proportionately than we ever have. And I think we got to keep building on that.
You made some news in December when you talked about how you hadn't been able to get an apartment in D.C. because you have bad credit after spending a lot of money on your campaign. Why did you want to share that story?
Well, two reasons. There's two reasons. Number one, I think it was important to make a point. I want, you know, I think vulnerability from our electeds is really important because it goes to show that, like, we're people too, but not just that. It's that a lot of these issues will continue with folks even when they get to like a seat of power, position of power. So I think that was really important. And I just wanted to be vulnerable with folks. The other thing is I was just kind of pissed off because I had just gotten the message that I was denied from the apartment. And so I was also a bit frustrated. And so, you know, in typical Gen Z fashion, I was taking to Twitter to air out a little bit of my frustration. But I'm glad that it ended up, you know, creating a, you know, they asked in a White House briefing about it. And so I'm glad that like the tweet led to a lot of broader conversations around housing and equity around housing, because it's something we don't talk about a lot, especially these barriers to even running for office. We've got to talk about.
Yeah. Well, I was going to ask you though about that, because I talked to a bunch of voters during the midterms, and the number one issue I heard about was cost of housing. And that was especially true with the group of young voters I spoke to. Like, what do you think Congress and the White House should do about that?
There's a lot that needs to be done. We know, like, the biggest levers on housing are pulled at the municipal and countywide level. But what the federal government can do is two things. Number one, bring money home, bring money to these municipalities and countywide governments so they have the resources they need to actually act on getting more housing, and not just more housing, affordable housing near opportunity. Like Orlando right now, Central Florida has one of the worst affordable housing crises in the country per capita. But the problem isn't just affordable. I can go 2 hours north of Florida and find great housing that's really cheap, but then that's 2 hours from the city center, right? It's not near opportunity. So we need money to come back to these communities, and it needs to bypass the state and go directly to the local governments. Like Florida's preempting everything right now. So it's important that local governments have resources. The second thing is pass laws that are, number one, going to protect renters and tenants, and number two, give renters and tenants more power in the marketplace. COVID, you know, showed a lot of things, you know, inequities in healthcare, et cetera. It also lessened the amount of power that tenants and renters have in the marketplace right now, because a lot of these huge conglomerates and these leasing companies, management companies, were able to buy up all this inventory. And now they own most of the inventory, especially in Central Florida. So you have a hard time finding a place that's affordable. And we know that when you move into a place, it's not just, oh, you pay first month's rent. You're paying first, you're paying last, you're paying your deposit, you got to furnish the place. That's a lot of money to have in your bank account to be able to move into a place in the first place. So there's a lot that needs to be. I think the federal government can do a lot to protect renters. We've talked about things like rent stabilization. We've talked about things like, you know, rent control. I think there's great opportunity here, but we have to talk about it because people are being evicted left and right, and they're having a hard time finding a place to live.
You've been an activist and an organizer. You ran partly because you were frustrated with lack of progress on issues like housing and guns and healthcare. You're now in the minority party in a divided government. What are your realistic goals for the next 2 years?
Well, the three issues we're going to focus on right out the gate are housing, gun violence, and we're also going to focus on music and arts funding, which is a huge thing in Orlando and Central Florida. We're a very culture-based city, and I think every one of those we can work on in a bipartisan way. We might not get the North Star I believe in these next 2 years. We've seen the dysfunction over the past week, so it seems like things even Republicans are for, they're going to have a hard time passing, let alone the things that I believe in. But I think there's ways that we can sneak in and get in good amendments or appropriations that are going to help fund a lot of these programs that are important. When we talk about gun violence, I know I say gun violence and everyone's like, they just passed the first piece of legislation in generations last year in the Democrat side of Congress. Well, there's a lot of other things we can talk about in gun violence that's beyond or different than gun regulation, which is the most controversial part. We need more gun regulation, but we also need money to go to fund community violence intervention programs, which are evidence-based programs that help end gun violence before it even happens. This is a lot of the work that a lot of people were protesting for during Black Lives Matter. We need money in our communities. We need money in our communities. This money goes to these community-based programs that help get kids off the streets and do a ton of different work to help end gun violence before it happens. A proactive solution, and I think we can get that type of money passed in a bipartisan way. At least I hope we can.
So, during the speaker fiasco, C-SPAN cameras were off their lockdown position. They were catching every moment. We all loved it. You loved it. Is there any hope, given how that we can stop the Republican majority in the Speaker's office from forcing C-SPAN to lock down the cameras? Can we keep the angles?
We're going to do everything we can to try. There's already some emails going around and people organizing around it. When we talk about bipartisan things, I saw Chip Roy talking about this too, and he's actually for freeing the C-SPAN cameras as well. We probably won't agree on almost anything this next Congress, but we agree on this. So I think there's appetite for it. There's obviously public appetite for it. I've offered my own help on ways we can organize around it. So we'll see. I think we're going to learn quickly. Couple days here, but I think there's an opportunity to keep the C-SPAN cameras free. I think it's important. Like, it makes democracy, number one, more exciting, obviously, but it also gives people an opportunity to have real accountability and accessibility in the House. I think a lot of us will read an article and think, oh, this set of members, they never talk with anyone besides themselves. But when you're on the House floor, you see that kind of everybody talks with everybody. And those kind of conversations, I think it's important for the public to see.
So, you were arrested in 2020 in a protest. You were sworn into Congress this week. You posted both your mugshot and your official portrait, but you said it wasn't a glow up. Is that a substantive representation of the values in those photos, or do you just really like your mugshot?
I don't like my mugshot. That was during the Black Lives Matter protests, the height of COVID. I hadn't gotten my hair cut in a long time.
I think you look good in that picture.
My friends call that mugshot my Lion King haircut because I just have so much hair. But either way, you know, I think it was important for me to post that. And the reason I posted the glow up thing is because I knew there'd be a lot of folks who, if I didn't put that, who would quote tweet and say, look at this glow up, look at this glow up. And that's not the point of that, you know. It's not that, oh, he was in jail and now he's a member of Congress. No, that's not, we're not trying to demonize people who are incarcerated a lot of times because of bogus laws and because of racism, et cetera. So that's why I posted that. It's not about a glow up. I'm the same person. I have the same values. I'm just now in a position here where I'm able, hopefully, to be able to uplift a lot of our arguments and what we believe in. And so I'm glad it's got a good reception and, you know, people are able to look at that kind of honesty and vulnerability, you know. And some of my opponents, like, used my mugshot during the campaign. And so,
Another,
I want to post it too because I'm proud of the work that we did. I'm proud of the fact that, you know, we took to the streets in nonviolent form to advocate for Black lives and for our communities. And so I'll gladly post it.
Last question, we'll let you go. A lot of people your age are ready to give up on politics for a lot of understandable reasons. You're in the fight now. You're a new member of Congress. You are, of course, going to have 2 years where, like you said, hopefully you can get some bipartisan accomplishments here and there, but it's going to be tough. A lot of people likely at the end of the next 2 years are going to say, ugh, Washington still seems broken, and why should I be involved? What do you want them to know about why you still feel politics is worthwhile?
Yeah, I was just talking about this morning. I think there's a few things real quick. The first one is we've been lied to for generations about how things work up here in order for people to get elected to office. So we have politicians who will say, vote for me, and this will happen tomorrow, this will happen next year. We all know that that's not how this process works. And what that does is sow in a lot of doubt into our voters who will vote for someone, not see the change in that 2 years, and then think, wow, my vote doesn't mean anything. And I don't blame people for feeling that way if that is, if the 2 years, right, is the span that thinking it. And so I've been honest with people, both in my district and in interviews. You know, I'm honest. I say, here's what I believe in. I cannot promise it will pass this year or next year because I'm one of 435 people. This is how the system works. But what I can promise you is what I believe in, how hard I'm going to fight for it, and what I'm going to do back at home. And we're all part of this together, right? Not propping myself as some savior, because that's not how this works, but all of us together. It's not just me working for my community. It's me working with my community. And I think when people see themselves as a part of that struggle with you, they're more likely to kind of understand the realistic approach, right? And they're less likely after 2 years to say, wow, we don't have Medicare, you know, for all, not everyone has healthcare. This is worthless. It's a broader struggle. The second thing is we have to be honest about a timetable here. And again, it has to do with these like 2 years, right? It goes beyond 2 years, right? This struggle is a generational thing for healthcare, for climate justice and gun violence, et cetera. And I think it's important to be honest with people about that, not to discourage them, right? but to make sure they're really bought into the current landscape. So that way everyone has the same expectations. We're not going to be able to get everyone on board with this, but every time I talk with people, anybody, I'm very honest about the fact that we're not going to see bold transformational change in the next 2 years out of the United States Congress. And I'll tell them why. It's we have a majority that doesn't believe in it. And it seems like even the things they do believe in, they're not even going to be able to get passed. But guess what? There's light at the end of the tunnel. In 2 years, we're going to be able to get back a Democratic majority, and we're going to be able to fight for what we believe in a better way and be set up to actually pass things. And so I think when you're honest with people, I think we should give people the benefit of the doubt, especially in our communities, and not be lying to them all the time about the powers of this office, because a lot of the power of this office comes from the people themselves, and they need to see themselves integrated in the process.
An organizer at heart. I love it. It's refreshing. Congressman Frost, thank you so much for joining Pod Save America, and good luck to you.
Thanks for having me on. Have a good day.
All right. Thanks to Congressman Frost for joining us today, and we'll talk to you on Thursday. Bye, everyone. Pod Save America is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our senior producer is Andy Gardner-Bernstein. Our producers are Haley Muse and Olivia Martinez. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis sound engineered the show. Thanks to Hallie Kiefer, Ari Schwartz, Sandy Gerard, Andy Taft, and Justine Howe for production support. And to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Phoebe Bradford, Milo Kim, and Amelia Montu. Our episodes are uploaded as videos at youtube.com/podsaveamerica.
It's called soccer.
It's called football.
Soccer.
Football.
Domino's Best Deal Ever lets you get any pizza, including stuffed crust, with any toppings for $9.99.
Okay, we can agree on that.
Yeah, fully.
So, pineapple? Don't ruin it. Get any pizza, including stuffed crust, with any toppings for $9.99. Finally, something everyone can get behind.
And if the rest disagree, that's between them and Domino's. Which means the only thing left to fight over is who's ordering.
Domino's.
Prices higher for some locations. Excludes XL and specialty pizzas. Select this offer from 6:15 to 7:26. Online only. Size availability varies by crust type. Max 7 toppings. 6 for pan and New York style crust. Minimum purchase required for delivery. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary.